You're listening to episode 254 of TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined as always by the great Dan Feinberg, the Hollywood Reporter's chief TV critic. How's it going, Dan?
Just drowning in programming. How about you, Leslie?
Oh, Dodgers off to a good start. I'm pretty happy and published a story I've been working on for 2 months this week. So
yeah, plug your story. Jeez. Well,
it's a depressing look at the state of the industry for TV writers post-strike, and spoiler alert, it's, again, depressing.
It's a really good story, though, because, you know, obviously on this podcast, we cover a lot of the biggest names in the industry, and that is, you know, one of the things we do, because what we have is a showrunner spotlight. This week we don't, but hopefully next week, you never know. But what's so great about the story that Leslie wrote is the number of junior writers, low-level writers, assistants, etc., that Leslie talked to, and just getting those voices out there and getting that perspective, I think, just makes that story a really excellent story.
Many thanks to all the people that I spoke with, especially the ones who were willing, as you said, to go on record and speak with their name attached. That's a very brave thing to do. Hats off, or in my case today, beanies off to the showrunners that I also spoke with that had more to lose, that didn't want to speak on record, but still wanted to talk for the story. And to all the other people and executives, everything else. I talked to a lot of people for this piece. So anyway, yeah, things are depressing. So that's not a great way to open this episode, but that's what I've been working on for 2 months. What about you, Dan? What are you in the midst of watching right now? I know you most of the stuff you're reviewing right now is under embargo, but can you give us any kind of teasers?
Well, in a couple minutes, we'll get to Critics Corner, and at least one of the shows that's one of the biggest shows currently in new release is a really, really good show. So we'll talk about it, though my review is already up for Ripley, so it's not like it's a huge surprise or anything. But anyway, I feel like I've actually been watching a lot of very interesting television, a lot of shows that are narratively and formally experimental, if not necessarily always successful. But still, it's basically, as we get towards Emmy season, a lot of the bigger titles that are coming out, even if not, you know, the streamers and cable networks and all that, even if they don't always know what they have, like I'm still not convinced necessarily that Netflix knows whether or not Ripley is any good. But we'll talk about that in both Critics Corner and in a question in the mailbag. So yes, so we do have a mailbag segment. It's a solid mailbag segment. We asked and got some decent questions. Definitely could have used some more, but you know, you can always email us at tvstop5@thr.com, tvstop5@thr.com. We'll get to more of that. And it's good to have mailbag segments when things don't necessarily come together as quickly as we would like on potential interviews, because sometimes it leaves us
like this
either,
week.
Yeah, like this week, which is technically a TV's top four, because that's just what we got stuff to talk about. Because let's be perfectly honest, no one really wanted us to try to figure out our way into the Disney shareholders vote story, which I must have read 800 times and was unable to find a way to justify it being a TV's top five story, much as I would have liked for it to have been, and much as it is unquestionably the biggest story of the week.
We defer to our wonderful colleague Kim Masters on the business.
Yes, definitely some of our colleagues have found ways to make it part of their jobs, just not ours, and that's okay.
Well, leading off, it's headlines.
Number one.
ABC has started handing out early renewals for its top scripted series, with Grey's Anatomy, Will Trent, and 9-1-1 all earning pickups for the 2024-25 broadcast season. So if this season feels like it's almost over, but it just started, that's because, well, that's what happened with the strikes. So you're starting to see a lot of the shows that have really come back strong, the slam dunks that these networks know that they want to keep on their schedules, get the early nods. Last week, I think we talked about NBC renewing 5 of its 6 Dick Wolf shows. CBS has already renewed a bunch, but you get the idea here. This is really ABC kind of playing catch up. Before this week, the only thing that they had renewed so far was Abbott Elementary, which, again, water is wet.
Does it feel like this is a little early for ABC? I feel like in the past, back when it used to be a much more involved thing, ABC was sometimes the one that waited until basically the last moment, last day, and then made all these announcements. So.
Yeah, it was like the Friday before upfronts, and it was like 5-minute embargo. We are renewing these 17 shows. And here's another 5-minute embargoes for 5 minutes after the other one that you're already working on, and we're canceling these shows. And then 5 minutes after that, here's another one with all the new series orders that we're handing out. Those days are thankfully behind us, because let me just share from a TV reporter vantage, that is stressful as fuck. So yeah, ABC, it's also like handing out early renewals is a great thing that you can do to keep creators happy. These are some of their biggest shows. Obviously, you got a Shonda Rhimes show, a Ryan Murphy show, and then Will Trent. That show has a lot of fans internally there. But yeah, it's not really a surprise with these three.
Yeah, I definitely do not miss those days of the last minute Friday before upfronts embargoes. I definitely did much less reporting back in those days than you did, but I still wrote the stories. And even that part of the process was significantly psychologically confusing and consuming. So I guess this is better, except for the ways that it's worse.
Well, I mean, it's more civil, and it's obviously like, there's like no shit you're going to renew Grey's Anatomy. Duh. Like, of course, get all the stuff out of the way, all the decisions that you need to get done, get BA out of the woods so that they can deal with all the last minute stuff that comes up closer to upfronts.
Continuing along with headlines, Hulu has canceled Death and Other Details, which was, of course, the Mandy Patinkin solves crime on a cruise ship mystery comedy thing, which
with a bizarro accent.
Definitely, he was doing a strange accent. There were a lot of strange accents. There were a lot of strange aspects to that show. It was also badly timed in the sense that it was the 900th murder mystery of that particular month that was popping up on television, which obviously didn't help it cut through. And I think it had the problem of feeling like the kind of show that people love. Like it felt like, okay, sure, it's another of those Agatha Christie type things. And if you like that,
out on a boat.
Exactly. And so you could understand what the audience was that it was aiming for. It just wasn't very good. So,
yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful looking show.
Even then, like it had the thing where it had great production design, but it was all done kind of in a green screen, and or felt like it was done on a green screen. I think they also did shoot in Europe some. Anyway, it just didn't come together, unfortunately, but yeah. So it goes.
And you can file this one also under So It Goes, or more like So He Goes. This just in, Netflix is changing showrunners on Avatar, The Last Airbender, ahead of its previously announced second and third seasons. Albert Kim, who replaced the show's original creators ahead of season one, has departed for an overall deal at Disney, where he will join Percy Jackson as an executive producer. Instead, Christine Boylan and Jabbar Rahsaani, who Albert Kim hired, will now take over as showrunners on seasons 2 and 3. Of course, those being the final two seasons for Avatar, The Last Airbender's live action remake. Dan, did you watch this one? Because I think Angie reviewed it, right?
She did. And I talked about it in a Critics Corner segment nigh on several weeks ago. It was okay. It never really felt like it found a purpose, but it's still, you know, it did significantly better than the M. Night Shyamalan movie. And I think that for a lot of people, seeing a better version of Avatar The Last Airbender live action was a sufficient enough purpose to justify its existence rather than actually being a good adaptation. Like, it had moments where it felt like it did some things decently, but it never at any point really to me felt like it said, okay, here's the reason why we had to make this live action, because the animation is so great in the original. It never felt mandatory. But will I watch second season? Sure. There were consistent enough elements that I found amusing. It's just sort of flat, unfortunately. And I just don't necessarily feel like this is a necessary trend that Netflix has mostly almost single-handedly pushed forward, the anime live action adaptation thing, just because occasionally you get one that's actually really kind of fun, like One Piece. So anyway, not mandatory, but also not offensive by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I won't poke fun at it designated Survivor style yet. Yet.
No, and look, it's a second season show. But though, I mean, obviously the show had its various stretches of creative issues. The animation creators were supposed to be the creators of the live action show at some point, and they bailed under very vocal and Instagram posty kind of terms and whatever. So there was some bumpiness to get to the first season in the first place. I don't know. A lot of people seem perfectly happy by the satisfied by the series. And so for some of those people, they may feel like losing a showrunner is going to be a big deal. But as you say, these were two people who were hand-selected to be part of the staff and are part of the first season and are part of the family. So it's not like they went they went far afield to find someone. It's continuity.
Yeah, and also Albert Kim put in a lot of time on this show. The original creators, I think, let's see, this was greenlit in, I want to say, 2018. And the original creators left in 2020. Kim was brought in shortly afterwards, developed the first season, got the show out the door. That's a 4-year job that he spent getting this show out the door, 8 episodes. So his deal with Netflix expired. He's ready to move on to something else. And that something else is Disney and Percy Jackson.
Makes sense.
Number 2.
Up second this week, it's March Madness, and all eyes are on Caitlin Clark. How happy am I that we're talking about a woman in sports right now? Very, the answer is.
And that's part of why we're talking about this, to be sure, but also part of why we're talking about it is, well, television. So how do we want to break down these numbers?
So let's just start with the facts here. So Iowa's 94-87 victory over LSU averaged 12.3 million viewers on ESPN. That marks the largest TV audience ever. I'm going to say it again, ever, for a women's basketball game in the United States. And it snaps a record from 40 years ago when CBS aired the title game in 1983 that featured USC legend Cheryl Miller, sister of Reggie Miller. So why is this important? Why are we talking about this now? Well, as Dan just said, this is TV, but you've got Caitlin Clark became the NCAA's all-time leading scorer for women and men earlier this season. And she is helping Iowa draw huge viewership throughout this tournament.
And I think that's why we're talking about this. And it's not just, I mean, okay, saying largest women's basketball audience in history, it eliminates the just from the conversation. That is significant and record-breaking. But if you want to take a step back even further, you can go, okay, well, that 12.3 million viewers, that was more than any game of last year's World Series. It was more than 4 of the 5 games of last year's NBA Finals. It was more than any game of last year's Stanley Cup. So this is why we're talking about it. We're talking about it because it's notable to see in 2024 that you can move the edge of the envelope, that you can move the needle, whatever it is, and you know who moved the edge of the needle. Caitlin freaking Clark moved the edge of the needle or the edge of the envelope or whatever it is. And that is significant.
Yeah. The Monday matchup also registered the second biggest audience for any game in the men's and women's tournament thus far, trailing only the 15.14 million viewers for North Carolina State men's upset of Duke on CBS on Sunday afternoon. And that's, again, a CBS broadcast versus a cable broadcast, as well as men versus women, et cetera. You get the idea, but just a massive tune in. And as one of my favorite accounts, The Gist, likes to say, women's sports, we are here. We are watching. Let's go.
And I know that I watch both. So it was a doubleheader. And the second game also did fairly well. The UConn-USC game with Paige Beckers and Juju Watkins, it did fairly well. It didn't do close to as well. And look, you can't reproduce the quote-unquote rivalry, which was 95% media generated in the first place between Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. I mean, yes, there was basically, it was a lot of stuff that the media wanted to talk about and the people wanted to make a big deal about. There were gestures at the end of last year's championship game, and some people took offense for reasons that are beyond bizarre, because you know, Caitlin Clark didn't take offense because Caitlin Clark likes trash talk as much as anyone, which is one of 15 things that are awesome about Caitlin Clark. So yeah, I watched both of the two games, the entire game of both of the two games. And I don't know that I watched the entirety of any game on the men's side. And I think that people knew that on a realistic level. I think that for various reasons, whether you want to say it's cyclical nature of talent, whether you want to say it's people going to the NBA, whether you want to say it's transfer portal that has caused teams to not necessarily be held together as long and therefore aren't as good. I think that people knew that this year the men's bracket was significantly less star-filled than the women's bracket. I just think that was simply the reality of how things were going to lay out. There is no one. Zach Edey is the biggest talent, literally and figuratively, on the men's side of the bracket. He's 7'4". He is remarkable to watch in terms of what he does. And I think people have kind of gotten around the idea that he's too big and slow to be in the NBA. I suspect at this point now that he's going to be a reasonably high first round draft pick, which wasn't the case last year when he was still the men's college player of the year. But still, so you have this one guy who is a fairly big star, but who's not a big personality type star. Whereas Caitlin Clark is both a record-breaking scorer. She's a personality. She has exactly the swagger that we like to watch our athletes have, but she's not the only one. I mentioned Paige Beckers, also fantastic athlete, totally got the personality that you want a star to have. Juju Watkins at USC, personality, talent, all that crap. South Carolina, the number one team in the bracket, has somehow become an afterthought, and they're an undefeated team because all of their biggest name stars graduated last year and are now in the WNBA, like the WNBA Rookie of the Year. But even still, everyone knew that's how this was going to go. And look, Iowa LSU was going to be the marquee, and it probably still is going to be. I think probably that they're going to get a good set of numbers for Caitlin Clark and Paige Beckers on Friday, when people are listening to this, Friday's game with UConn and Iowa. I think people will tune in for that, I suspect. And then if either of those two teams playing against South Carolina, I think that'll get ratings. And I suspect probably better than most of the potential men's Final Four and final permutation. I think a UConn-Purdue finals, two number one seeds, some big talented players, defending national title, trying to repeat for the first time since those great Florida teams in the 90s. I think that'll get numbers and probably will get more than 12.3 million viewers. I think that's just likely because, as you say, it'll be on CBS and all of that. But anyway, 12.3 million viewers for a women's basketball game, for Caitlin Clark, for all of that, that is significant. And it is significant as a TV story in addition to a sports story. So we wanted to talk about it. But it's also not just TV. It's spread into one of your favorite corners of the sports adjacent world as well, right?
Yeah, the hobby. You can get a Caitlin Clark rookie card graded. And if you don't know what that means, don't worry about it. You can get a nice Caitlin Clark card for under $100, but the hobby has, she's lit up the hobby. It's great to see, for not just for collectors, but for women in the hobby as well. So
that's been our first and maybe last TV's Top 5 Talks About Women's College Basketball segment, but darned if we didn't want to do it because it was worth talking about. Up third.
Number 3.
As we mentioned, mailbag. We asked for mailbag questions. We got some mailbag questions. We could always use more mailbag questions because, well, we also like answering mailbag questions. So please send us your mailbag questions at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Up first, a question from a listener on Twitter. The listener asks, with all the chatter about the yearning to return to longer seasons, how many episodes of TV were made during the best years of peak TV? Did more shows actually equal less television? Did prestige overshadow this? This is a math question, Leslie, and we are not going to answer it as a math question, are we?
It was my understanding there was to be no math, said every journalism major ever. So yeah, I'm not going to do the math. Here's as much as I'm going to think about it, though. Okay, so the high for peak TV in 2022 was 600. And this is, again, research credit to FX. If you figure all 600 of those shows had, at the minimum, 8 episodes per, that's still 4,800 episodes of television in a single year. And you know that there were a big portion of these that were broadcast shows. You may have had closed-ended stuff, things that were 10 and 13, et cetera. Like 5,000 episodes in a single year. Let's just go with that number as a ballpark.
You're
Does
just making
shows
things up
actually
now.
Equal less television? I'm going to say no, because like as long as we've been doing this show, Dan, the one refrain has remained true, and that's there is simply too much television. That is a fact, you know, and I think part of the contraction that we're seeing now, and you can go back and listen to our interview with 20th TV president Carrie Burke about it. And her theory was less television means it will actually get better, you know, because these networks and streamers might actually take more time to develop stuff and not try to rush things through. And I think if you look at the pilot landscape right now, you're going to see that. Yes, you have a couple of things that were picked up straight to series, but like the longer you get a jump, and we've talked about this so many times, I always use Night Court as a great example of seeing what happens when you take time to make the show and get it right versus trying to pick up the pilot in January, cast it in February, produce it in March, edit it, get it on in the air. And then all of a sudden in May, it gets a 10 episode order. Like, no one makes anything that's great that way. The better the show, the more time you're going to take to make it, as you can see with things like Shogun, for example. So I think, yes, do we want to see more episodes of television? I think the Suits phenomenon on Netflix was a great example of yes. The answer to that is indeed yes. But I don't think that more shows actually meant less television. I think more shows meant more television. Dan.
I think that's true. And I'd also, like, I'd say just from my perspective, and this is sort of the critical perspective, like back in the day, yes, broadcast shows would have 22, 27, whatever episodes. But when your typical friendly neighborhood TV critic would be handling them, we would be reviewing those shows off of one episode, off of the pilot. We'd be reviewing those shows off of two episodes or three if we were lucky. So yes, the fall would roll around and there would be 20 new broadcast shows that would premiere in 5 days. And that might mean 20 reviews, but it would be 20 reviews off of 20 hours of television in that case being 43 minutes, as opposed to in a situation where in any given week these days, I might only have 3 shows to review, but it would be between 8 and 10 episodes because they're on different streamers. And so I would get 8 to 10 episodes of them. That's a lot more television to watch in terms of what I'm basing my reviews on. And then the theory would be also that reviews are more reliable in that case because they're based on more information and all of that. So yeah, none of this is what the original questioner was asking for, because the original questioner asked for math, and there's nobody on this podcast who is capable of doing that.
Up next, listener Buddy asks, with the last season of Letterkenny out, we're finally watching it. Who is Dan's favorite character or two?
Too many characters, too many favorites. That's why Letterkenny is so great. Letterkenny, all available on Hulu. People should watch it. It's a very, very, very fast binge. Many seasons, most of the seasons, 6 to 8 episodes, 21 minutes apiece. Boy, you make through that show in a hurry. No, the easy answer is that there's absolutely no way to have just one favorite character, and that's why the show is so great. So while I might say that Squirrely Dan is my favorite character, probably in a broader sense, and that's what I appreciate most about him, over various stretches of episodes, countless characters I love nearly as much. I mean, Katie Cat, Michelle Mylett, love her very much. Great character. Sort of in terms of like a supporting character, the character who over the course of however many seasons Letterkenny aired, 12, 13, I lost count at some point, 13, 14, who grew on me most and who I found myself most marveling about as the show went along was Evan Stearns Roald, who it was basically kind of a background character in the first couple seasons. He was basically Stewart's gay sidekick, and he became such a wild and outlandish character, not just because of the pleasure of the way that he said Stewart's name, Stewart, etc., but just because of what Evan Stern was able to do to the line readings, the strange times that they let that character dance. Anyway, so yes, I love Roald. So the answer for 3 favorite characters was Squirtly Dan, Katie, and Roald, but so many different characters. If I don't mention Tannis, then the dear lady will come and get me. That's a television across multiple TV shows reference. Yes, great. And then, you know, Bonnie McMurray. Anyway, great show. Everyone should watch Letterkenny. Yay, Letterkenny.
Our next question comes from friend of the five, Alan Seppenwall.
Excuse me, best friend of the five.
Sorry, you
can't,
my bad.
You can't down... God, this would kill Alan if you downgraded him, not just from very good friend of the five, just a friend.
Our next question comes from BFF of the five, Alan Seppenwall, who writes, why do streamers sometimes embargo reviews of shows that are likely to be critical darlings until either right before they premiere or after they're already available for the public to watch? In movie publicity, any film that either has a late embargo or holds no advanced screenings is assumed to be a stinker that the studios don't want to damage with bad reviews. But more often than not, it seems like when a TV show has a day of premiere review embargo, it's something really good, like Ripley or Fall of the House of Usher. And Peacock, for example, embargoed Poker Face until the day before it premiered, when they were desperate for people to care about any of their shows. So to borrow a favorite TV's top five phrase, what's up with that? And even though Leslie is not a critic, I welcome her theories in addition to Dan's.
The truth is, Alan Sepinwall, best friend of the five, that I think probably that it's a different answer in almost every case, and that in some cases, there are obviously still television shows that are getting day of premiere embargoes in large part because the streamers, networks, et cetera, know that it's garbage and whatever. And I think that Netflix probably has one or two shows per week that are, let's just say, not made for critics, where we get screeners and it's a day of embargo. I think they've basically standardized that most animated shows are, for whatever reason, day of premiere embargo. Some of them, it's because they're kind of trashy and bad. Others of them, there's no particular logic. But like the new Good Times, which had its trailer premiere last week to online buzz that was less than positive, it's got a day of premiere embargo, and not particularly surprising on that. Other times, though, there's just no consistency. And that's where the confusion of it all gets to me, that there are some shows where, let's just say with Fall of the House of Usher, that part of the reason why you would put a day of premiere embargo would be based on concern about spoilers, and that it would be partially that and partially they just don't feel like they need it because the Mike Flanagan October Halloween-y type show is a factory and it's an institution and people know to look for it, etc. I don't know that I buy that, and I don't know that I buy it especially because so many of those shows have gotten very good reviews. But I can see that as a justification. But, you know, like, and using Netflix as an example, they've had a lot of shows, I would say, that are good shows that have slipped through the cracks because Netflix has made it complicated for reporters, critics, whatever, to write about the shows. And then when they've been good shows, we're kind of back on our heels being like, you should have watched that. And then Netflix cancels it 60 days later. And we're like, wait, so what was even the point of the entire thing? So Brother Son would be a casual example of that, a show that Netflix gave the impression that it wasn't a very good show by having a day of premiere embargo. It was a better show than that. It was a show that lots of people probably would have enjoyed, but it just never found any sort of momentum and was canceled. Teenage Bounty Hunters is an example of a show that just infuriates me. That was a show that needed critical support. It was a show that I don't think Netflix anticipated was a show that would get good reviews. And so they basically buried it. They made it completely invisible. Then it came out and critics were like, well, this is actually a good show. This is a really likable, enjoyable show. And it just never found the momentum. But it's just so inconsistent. So sometimes a show like All the Light We Cannot See on Netflix, well, that had an embargo that lifted 2 months before because Netflix premiered it at the Toronto Film Festival. And so it was going to get reviews. And I think Netflix probably thought that it was going to get more positive reviews than it did. It got torn to shreds. But I think they thought that, okay, well, so it'll get some good reviews and word of mouth will just sort of build and we'll put it out in November. And yeah, everyone will watch it. And I think people did watch it. It looked like it was in the top 10 for a long time, but definitely, you know, there were just all those negative reviews that were just sitting there. And I don't know if maybe someone at Netflix thought that Ripley would, I don't know, be too chilly for people. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. Or if they just felt that it's hard to say if they felt like the brand was what was going to sell it and not reviews. And so the fact that Ripley comes out and day of premiere, it's got, you know, raves from such publications as The Hollywood Reporter and Rolling Stone and many others, it just sort of, yeah, I don't know what it does to the perception. It eliminates the ability for a buildup previously of word of mouth. It just assumes people will find it now. There's no spoiler-based logic to holding off on reviews. It's, you know, it's the exact same story as two movie versions of The Talented Mr. Ripley and a beloved book. So I could tell you exactly what happens every moment of The Talented Ripley, rather, and I wouldn't be spoiling it. Yeah, it's frustrating is the simple answer, because in some cases I want to tear shit to shreds and I want to be like, yeah, just want to bring out my claws, bring out my teeth, all of that. And in some cases, I just want to tell people that things are good. And all I want to do is be like, please, let me help you. Let me be a promotional arm of your network. That is not what I consider my job to be, but let me bang the drum for your good show. And I can't. And so anyway.
Yeah, it's odd when this happens. I mean, this is obviously much more in your wheelhouse than it is mine. My only thing in this case for Ripley is, do you have a showrunner who's available to do press? Do you have a cast that's available to do press? Or by available, I mean that wants to do press. You know, so this may have been part of a larger strategy of saying, like, look, we don't have any big features in the works. No one wanted to do anything or whatever. Or people were too worried that because Showtime dumped it, that it's going to look like, you know, this is Netflix picking up scraps. Obviously, we know that that's not what the case is here because you've seen it, you liked it. But it's also like Showtime didn't dump it because it wasn't good. They dumped it because they're really not making anything unless it's like some huge tentpole thing that they've already done before. And even that's not true. You know, like they were going to do Weeds, you know, a Weeds update with Mary Louise Parker. And then that's one of the projects that got dumped during the strike. Look, there's a lot of reasons why people don't have good press strategies. And I think part of the problem in this industry, and I'll get on my soapbox here for a second, but we lost a lot of really good veteran, experienced, super smart publicists in 2020 when everyone was having massive waves of layoffs. And that's not to discredit the people who are in these jobs now. But what I'm saying is when you lose that experience, you lose a lot of strategy. And I don't know what the strategy is here, but I would love to find out. So if you have an exec at Netflix who's listening to this and you want to chime in or shoot me an email or signal or smoke signal or whatever it is about why this was embargoed in terms of the review for launch day, I'd be happy to hear that. But look, you know, when you get onto Netflix and there's something new, it pops right up at you. It serves it straight to you. It's spoon feeding you what they want you to watch. And reviews can do that in an easier way too. You know, like maybe this was just their way of saying, you know what, we don't have anyone available to do press. This is based on IP. It should be able to sell itself. We'll have the reviews be the marketing tool. You know, the same way that people use trailers and first look photos. Those are all marketing things, right? So maybe that's what they're looking to the reviews to market the show because they didn't have anything either in a marketing budget or they didn't have it, people who were connected to the show who were available and wanted to do it. So that's just a guess and just a theory because that would make sense. But again, you know, with Poker Face, that was a strategy that was just like, really? Maybe that was the same reasoning. I don't know. It felt like Natasha Lyonne and Rian Johnson did a lot of press for that one. But again, it's, you know, when you have something that's good, maybe these people who are involved with it, just they want to take a victory lap after the fact. I don't know.
And like you say, the difference, though, between a Netflix, which simply has the ability to put something in that magical top square and know that it will magically become a phenomenon. That is the beauty and the power of the Netflix algorithm. They know they can do that. And they know that they get the rights to the accountant. And if you put the accountant up in that top square, suddenly the accountant becomes the biggest movie in America for a few days because Netflix put it in the top square. So Netflix can do that. What Peacock did on Poker Face was just dumb. Peacock needs the push for positive press and positive reviews on shows like Poker Face. Netflix might just figure it doesn't. And there's enough anecdotal evidence that that's true to convince some people that it's true. I already gave several pieces of evidence of times that it wasn't true. And I could give a half dozen or a dozen comparable instances in which Netflix not pushing a show simply led to the shows dying as opposed to led to good shows dying in specific, as opposed to bad shows disappearing. If Netflix has a bad show and they don't want to get word out about it, burying it makes total sense. I just can't imagine that Netflix thought that burying Ripley was a thing that made any sense to anybody. And they're not burying it, but I don't know. That again, let me help you. That's all I want to do in some cases is say, watch this. It's good. There's good TV. Watch it.
And if you've spent millions of dollars making the show or buying the show, why don't you want to market it? I don't understand. Anyway, conversation for another time. A reminder, if you have a question you'd like to hear us discuss on the podcast, drop us an email at tvstop5. That's the number 5 at thr.com. Up next, as usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner.
Number 4.
Among this week's Major new launches, you've got Ripley, which we just talked about, Sugar on Apple, Dinosaur on Hulu, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office on PBS, and HBO's Alex Edelman, Just for Us. Dan, what do you got?
Lots of stuff, lots of good stuff. I'm going to save Ripley and Sugar because they're kind of the marquee premieres for the end, but that doesn't mean that the other stuff isn't pretty decent. I would say actually that Alex Edelman, Just for Us, is probably, we'll see. It's either my first or second favorite thing of the things premiering this week. It is HBO's filmed version of Alex Edelman's 90-minute one-man show, comedy special. It's one of those things where basically when something is 66 minutes, we call it a stand-up special. When something is 90 minutes, we say it's a one-man show or something to that effect. So this is 90 minutes, so it's a one-man show, technically, I suppose. Also, it played on Broadway, it played on London's West End, it played in Los Angeles, so that makes it easier to say. Alex Edelman is a comedian, and basically the premise of this is that he fielded comments on Twitter from neo-Nazis and decided that he was going to make a Twitter list of neo-Nazis. And via that Twitter list, he saw an invitation to a neo-Nazi get-together in Queens. And he decided to go, with the additional piece of information that Alex Edelman is an Orthodox Jew, raised very, very Jewish, continues to be very, very Jewish. And so the special is his exploration of his Judaism, his exploration of empathy, Jewish empathy and general empathy. And it's also really, really hilarious. I think that it's a total treat. I think probably it would have been more fun to see live, go figure, being with an audience and all of that. But I laughed hard, and I laughed hard throughout the HBO version of Just for Us, which of course will be on Max after it premieres. So strong recommendation for Alex Edelman, Just for Us. Going through things that I have some recommendation for, Dinosaur on Hulu has absolutely nothing to do with the dinosaurs. It is actually about two sisters living in Glasgow. One of them is on the autism spectrum, and the other one is about to get engaged. And the engagement upends their life and their careful routines and rhythms and becomes a series of funny misadventures. And it is indeed a series of funny misadventures. Ashley Story is the co-creator, and she plays the sister on the autism spectrum, and she is extremely funny and extremely Scottish, which is extremely charming. Generally, though, it's just an amusing six-episode romp that gets pretty emotional in the last couple episodes. This is one of those instances where the British comedy system of what the hell, let's just do four episodes, or let's just do six episodes, and this is even more remote because it started as one of those pilots that aired on UK TV like 5 years ago and then eventually got made into a series. I'm never completely sure on the rules of that. We've interviewed at least one showrunner whose stuff came from a similar pipeline where it basically, I think We Are Lady Parts did that, where it was a pilot and then a couple years later, the actual series came along. Where I wish that it could be 8 to 10 episodes, because I think the dramatic beats in the second half of the story could have been better if they'd had just a little bit more breathing room. But again, Ashley Story is great. Kat Roney, who plays the other sister, also very, very good. Lots of good supporting roles. It's going to be an entire cast of people who, if you don't know Scottish comics, you probably won't know. But yeah, it's a good sort of quirky comedy in the British vein. And you know if you like that kind of thing, and worth checking out as the kind of thing that it is. Mr. Bates versus the Post Office is premiering as part of a Masterpiece PBS run that will be, I believe, premiering on Sunday, I think. It's already been a phenomenon in the UK. It both drew a huge audience when it premiered on ITV, but more importantly, it produced a renewed wave of outrage around the very real, very large UK Postal Service scandal, which shook the UK and had no impact whatsoever on the United States. So there's a pretty good chance that if you are a casual American viewer and not an Anglophile, you know absolutely nothing about the British Post Office scandal. But what works so well about the series is it takes about 15 minutes for you to just sit there and get angry. And you can be really angry about both something that you knew nothing about 15 minutes earlier, that has no impact on your life, and that has been almost fully resolved in the UK. So you could just sit there being totally annoyed, outraged, and pissed off, while it's also just a really, really good underdog story with Toby Jones leading the way, playing one of the postmasters who basically got accused of fraud because of a vast British post office computer system flaw that no one associated with the Postal Service was willing to admit existed, while at the same time prosecuting and sending postmasters to jail for a computer error that no one wanted to admit existed. Like, people committed suicide because this ruined lives. So yeah, it's four episodes long. They're 47 minutes apiece. It goes very fast, and you will be very angry about something that you didn't know anything about before you started watching, which to me counts as effective television. It's very broadly on the nose. Like, all of the Postal Service characters, they might as well be twirling mustaches. On the other hand, this was a horrible miscarriage of justice, so they might as well have been twirling their evil mustaches. So that would be Mr. Bates versus the Post Office on PBS. I do not expect it is going to become the same sort of phenomenon here that it was in the UK, but, you know, it's pretty good. So let's get to the big titles. Up first, Sugar on Apple TV Plus, which is created by Mark Protasevich, and it stars Colin Farrell. You know Colin Farrell. And it's another of those missing persons private investigators dramas, and only like the 900th of the spring or of the year so far. It has a twist, but it doesn't actually reveal the twist until well over halfway into the series. And by that time, the series has become so consumed with the teasing out of the twist that the actual plot line of the show gets really, really lost and ceases to be all that interesting. And once the twist comes, it's an interesting twist. You'll either find it fun or you'll find it ludicrous, but that's like any twist. Will you be able to predict it? Maybe. Once the twist comes, you're like, okay, let's learn more about the twist, but that's all going to be in season two, and that's kind of frustrating. So season two is going to be what the show is. Season one is all about the twist and kind of this secondary plot line. What is the secondary plot line, you ask? Because I've said absolutely nothing about it. It's also the primary plot line. Colin Farrell is a gumshoe. He finds missing people, and he is also a huge, huge Hollywood movie fan, and he gets a case that involves a super producer, a classic Hollywood super producer, played by James Cromwell. His granddaughter has gone missing. The granddaughter is played by Sydney Chandler, Kyle Chandler's daughter, who's been in a number of things recently, so I've gotten to mention that. She looks strangely like Kyle Chandler in certain shots and nothing at all like Kyle Chandler in other shots. It's kind of fun. Genetics, man, genetics. So he tries to find the missing girl who has a drug addiction and has vanished before, but it turns out she's vanished as part of a vast conspiracy, as such things go. And so he tries to get to the bottom of it. Among the people who are sort of involved in the investigation are Amy Ryan, who plays a former rock star, and then other various guest stars who are very good. Colin Farrell is super. I think that he is just really good here. He's very confident. He's very casual. He teases out parts of a characterization that kind of fit eventually with the twist, maybe. But generally, it's just a good performance as a hard-boiled detective. You don't even need the twist. Give me Colin Farrell as a hard-boiled gumshoe. I am there for that. That's just not what the show is. So I don't know. Some people will be totally invested in the twist and will be like, yay, I can't wait, and will really, really want to figure it out. And that'll be the fun for some people. Other people will find the coyness to be a little bit obnoxious and to get increasingly more obnoxious as it goes. I would say I was more in the obnoxious camp, finally, when all was said and done. So on the twist, that is. On the show in general, mixed is what I will say. Some people, though, will be more caught up than others. And finally, last but not least, reviews were embargoed for day of premiere on Ripley for no particular reason, because Ripley, created by Schindler's List writer and Searching for Bobby Fischer director Steve Zaillian, it's really good. At times, it's genuinely excellent, and in ways, it's genuinely excellent. Another example of coyness, they're referring to how it is based on the Ripley novels by Patricia Highsmith. It's based on The Talented Mr. Ripley. That is what it is. It's not some sort of hybrid of all of the books or anything, though there are definitely teases to the other books if you know the other books. But no, it's Talented Mr. Ripley, and it's Talented Mr. Ripley in the same way that the wonderful Anthony Minghella movie is The Talented Mr. Ripley, in the same way that Purple Noon, directed by Renee Clements and starring the great Alain Delon, is a great movie. And for me, you got to give things a little bit more time to mellow and sink in before you declare greatness. But I think it's possible that I could end up looking back on Ripley as being a great TV show. I really do. We'll see kind of what it looks like as I get to top 10 season at the end of the year. I can easily imagine myself looking back and going, yeah, this was really and truly just one of the best shows of the year. That's just what it is. It is kind of in that Queen's Gambit kind of area of period pieces / literary adaptations that are just smart television for grownups. And Steve Zaillian made it an example of that with HBO's The Night Of, which is one of those great prestige limited series that I don't feel like people talk about all that much for whatever reason. It's, you know, won a bunch of Emmys, all that good stuff. But, you know, sort of a little bit under the radar somewhat. It wasn't at the time. At the time, it was a big deal. Everyone was like, ooh, Riz Ahmed. Hello. Hi, Riz Ahmed. Ooh, John Turturro scratching his feet. Bunch of stuff like that. But yes, so Steve Zaillian wrote and directed all 8 episodes of this. Of even equally important merit is Robert Elswit, the cinematographer, who is a great feature cinematographer and is a great television cinematographer, because really he's just a great cinematographer. The black and white photography in Ripley is stunningly gorgeous. It is evocative. It is painterly. The Caravaggio paintings that pepper through Europe and that are a key part of the plot of the show inspire the use of light and shadow. Like, every frame of this show really and truly could be a painterly image. It is gorgeous. The number of inspirations, countless. In my review, I noted that a lot of people are going to call it noir. I don't think it's honestly noir at all. I think that is not what it is, because noir is a specific thing. Noir is a specific thing that we've kind of lost the definition of, because the truth is there were 50 films that are actually film noir, and then we open up the definition to hundreds of other mysteries that it just happened to be in black and white. This is not that. This looks much more like Hitchcock's black and white output from the 40s and 50s. It looks more like Ilya Kazan's treatment of urban centers in the 50s and 60s. It looks like certain Italian films of that period. It looks like Roberto Rossellini. It looks like Michelangelo Antonioni. That's what it looks like to me, much more than noir. I don't think it's noir at all, but it's gorgeous. And that's the important thing. Anyway, Andrew Scott plays the lead role. He is fantastic. He is way too old for the part. And either you say he's way too old for the part. He's 47 and he looks younger than that. Of course he does. He's whatever. He passes for 35 easy. But if you compare the way he's playing Tom Ripley to the way that Matt Damon and Alain Delon played him, the maturity changes the story and it changes what this particular sociopath's MO feels like. And I think a lot of this is about the chilling nature of privilege, because these are characters who are in their 30s, maybe even their 40s, and are adrift and are basically glorified tourists in a world of people who are trying to live their lives, and they're just spinning around and doing nothing. And I think it just becomes a more desperate thing. And I think that the black and white cinematography captures the desperation of it. It captures the somber sadness of it. But the show is not exclusively somber and sad. It is very funny. I think that in the second half of the show, when Mauricio Lombardi shows up as a Rome police investigator, I think he is hilarious. I think it is truly one of my favorite performances on television, let's just say this year rather than ever. But it's a great performance. Mauricio Lombardi, he plays Inspector Pietro Ravini, and he's hilarious. He's droll, he's sarcastic, he's got these great sad eyes, and he shows his sadness through his contempt for these Americans who are going around killing each other and wasting his time with subterfuge. And I think it's a wonderful performance. I think Andrew Scott is wonderful. Johnny Flynn as Dickie Greenleaf. He is specifically not playing the same version of Dickie Greenleaf as Jude Law did. He is not the endlessly youthfully exuberant Dickie Greenleaf. He's this Dickie Greenleaf who's in his mid-30s. He's a dilettante in a number of art forms, living off a trust fund, etc. He plays it like that, not like an endless ball of youth. Dakota Fanning, very good as Marge, simultaneously the only person who is consistently skeptical of Tom Ripley, but also very silly and dumb in her own way. And then lots of great cameos throughout. So Bokeem Woodbine pops up in a couple episodes as a private investigator trying to find Ripley. Kenneth Lonergan, the great playwright and movie writer and director, plays Dickie Greenleaf's father. A bunch of other cameos that I wouldn't dare spoil. Anyway, so yes, it drags the story out a little bit more than some people will want, because some people find it uncomfortable to sit watching a sociopath for 8 hours and feeling like you're maybe supposed to identify with them or sympathize with them or whatever. I still think it works extremely well. I think that there aren't many deviations in terms of plot. There are deviations in tone. There are deviations in characterization. I think they're all very interesting, especially if you love the books, if you love the previous adaptations, etc. You know, I have no idea how it stands completely and totally on its own. I just know that I am a large fan of the property of the story and of the adaptations, and that this is another exceptional adaptation. So strong recommendation for Ripley, strong recommendation for Alex Adelman, just for us, reasonable recommendation for Dinosaur and Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, and lots of people really will like Sugar. Some people, however, will be very frustrated by Sugar. So that's just the warning.
For more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Reporter's Now See This newsletter and bookmark thr.com/TV-reviews for more. That feels like a good place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. They help spread the word of out. You can always come say hi to us on various social medias. She is, as always, at Snoodit with 2 O's. I am, as always, at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And I feel as if we've mentioned this at least 5 times already in this podcast. If you have questions for future mailbag segments, email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.